Adrenaline dump. The room fell silent as the implications of that sank in.
Bloody hell, said Wilson after a while. This will turn those fixers who are already in bleeding-edge body armor into supermen. And then it will kill them, triggering the explosives.
Everyone in the room looked sick and scared, even Church. Footage taken from Tops and Bunny's button cams have shown that quite a few of the fixers at the pavilion have surgical scars, said Coleman. So we can assume these packets have already been implanted. Since Top and Bunny are relatively new recruits, they haven't yet received these implants. The others, though?
Maybe we can try to tell the fixers this, ventured Nikki. Maybe we can tell them that their employers have turned them into suicide bombers.
That would be great, said Coleman. But,
dear Lord, save me from scientists who say but, pleaded Wilson.
Sorry, said Coleman, and there was just a hint of the same ghoulish excitement on Doc Holliday's face. There's a kicker, and it's a kicker that really does make this worse.
Then just hit us with it, said Church.
Even though we don't have samples of R-33, which is apparently their latest generation, we do know what they intended to add to it to make the super fixers even more dangerous.
Christ,
breathed Wilson, and he literally grabbed the arms of his chair as if bracing for a blow. These packets will contain trace amounts of rage. Chapter 110. Das Verarbeitungszentrum. The black car idled at the edge of the parking lot, and the three passengers watched the processing plant burn. They saw two helicopters land, and several small figures in black and one in orange climb aboard. The chopper lifted into the air just as a line of police cars came screaming into the lot from two entrances.
Holy moly, breathed Harry Bolt. Did Joe do all that?
What do you think? Asked Toys snidely. That bloke could start a riot in an empty room.
Violin studied the figures, still visible as the helicopters climbed into the air.
Those were soldiers of some kind, she said, in body armor. Not a style I recognize.
How can you see that without binoculars? Asked Toys, but Violin only smiled.
Harry said,
she has superpowers. You wouldn't believe some of the things Violin can... Hush now,
she murmured, and he hushed. The police cars screeched to a halt in front of the building and the officers piled out, some pointing their weapons at the choppers, but there was no chance of a hit. The machines were climbing and turning.
Any sign of our boy?
Asked Toys. Violin looked around. For a moment it seemed as if she were about to say something, but then shook her head. Suddenly a new series of explosions rippled through the building, and then an absolutely massive detonation lifted the entire roof off and hurled flaming chunks of concrete across the parking lot. The police scattered, but most of them were caught by the blast or knocked down by flaming debris.
Christ, gasped Toys. We need to help them, said Violin.
We need to find Joe, said Harry.
No, said Toys. She's right. We need to help.
And the car drove into the parking lot. Chapter 111. Skandik, Berlin, Potsdamer Platz, Gabriel Turgut, Promenade 19, Berlin, Germany. First thing I did was find a public trash can on a deserted city street, pull over, and dump the remaining bee drones and my mind reader gear into the metal can. Then I stripped off my own body armor. Last, I activated four blaster plasters that I hadn't needed to use. I raced back to my car and was halfway down the block when it all blew up. It was a big and very hot fireball that I knew would completely incinerate everything. All anyone would find was slag. Nothing was traceable to begin with, but now it was not even remotely recognizable as what it might have been. While I drove, I muttered apologies to Doc and Bug. Then I took a long and complex route back to my hotel in Berlin. I stopped my car on a different side road halfway there and spent some time changing out of my combat rig and into a nondescript suit with a drab tie and fake eyeglasses. Cleaning the blood off Ghost took a while, and he whined and glared as if I were doing something truly awful to him. "Stop being a big baby," I scolded, and he replied with a loud and eloquent fart. My hands shook as I worked. Partly it was the adrenaline still trying to get my nerves and muscles to fight or flee. It takes a lot longer for that to wash out of the bloodstream than it does to inject it in. Comes with a bit of nausea, too. Mostly, though, I was scared. And relieved? I'd done the whole mission without the darkness taking me over, and that was something I had to actually think about to make sure I was correct. But there were no memory gaps. I could map out every minute of my time inside the processing plant, so yay. On the other hand, I'd seen ghosts. Spoken to ghosts. To my brother, Sean. If it had been Sean. When his eyes changed. That was how Top, Bunny, and Rudy had all described someone else's eyes changing color. It was a name of a person I was sure had died in California at Church's hands. At least that's what I thought. I hesitated even thinking the name. But it came anyway, and my lips and tongue and breath stained the air with it. Nicodemus, I whispered. Ghost whined and curled his tail between his legs as he had back in Casanova's cell. He's coming for you, Joe. If you keep hunting Santoro and Kuga, you'll find him, and he really wants you to find him, cowboy. Oh, yes, he does. He wants that so much. God Almighty. I debated driving to a church, any church, instead of back to my hotel. And if I thought that would have helped, I'd have done it. Instead, I drove us into town, parked the car myself rather than let a nosy valet have it, and went up to my room. I ordered enough food for 6 people, and while I waited for room service, I showered and spent a few minutes just standing under the spray. Maybe I lost some time, I don't really know. What I do know is that I have no clear memory of drying off or getting dressed again. That should have scared me more than it did. And the fact that it didn't scare me should have really freaked me out. It was as if I could stand a few feet away and objectively observe the process of my own psychological fragmentation. The knock on the door shook me out of those kinds of thoughts. Like any good, total paranoid nut job, I peered through the peephole while pressing a gun barrel to the door panel. But it was a bored-looking 20-something in a hotel uniform. I slid the pistol into my waistband and pulled the shirt out to cover it, signed the check, added a couple of extra euros to the already exorbitant pre-calculated tip, carried the tray inside, and closed and locked the door. I set 2 of the trays on the floor for Ghost. Medium rare steak on one, chicken fingers on the other, both with lots of fries. Ghost ate them one at a time and with great delicacy. While I ate, I typed up an after-action report. When I'd hit town, I'd purchased a low-end laptop because I thought I'd have a lot to record. A computer's memory was far more reliable than my own Swiss cheese brain. Once I was ready to check out of the room, I'd email the data to Bug and then abandon the laptop here. Even though I was not technically operating under any kind of orders from Mr. Church, there were things he needed to know. The report had almost all of it. The fixers, their newfangled tech, the strange psychological weirdness, the suicide vests, the resistance to Sandman, and the presence of Eve. I omitted everything about Casanova, though, and I didn't bother providing any explanation as to why I'd broken into the processing plant in the first place. That was need to know, and they didn't. As I typed, I could see them in the laptop screen's reflective surface, the silent figures clustered behind me as if ready to take a family portrait. No, I told them.
Ghost looked at me and then at the wall behind me. He came and put his head on my thigh. It's okay. I lied. Everything's going to be okay. When I looked at the reflection again, there was nothing behind me but empty wall. I could smell something, though. A burned meat stink. I tried to close it out, grinding my teeth together so hard my jaws hurt. I finished the report and emailed it off, got up, walked into the bathroom, and threw my guts up in the toilet. Then I crawled back into the shower, wrapped my arms around my head, and totally lost my shit. Chapter 112 Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Bug came out of his office at a dead run. He found Church in the canteen, sitting down with a cup of coffee, a plate of vanilla wafers, and a stack of reports. Bug skidded to a breathless halt. "What is it?" asked Church. "It's Germany," he said. "Damn, boss, this is nuts."
"Sit," said Church. "Take a breath and tell me."
"First, Joe trashed his mind reader substation. He's gone dark again."
"That was expected."
"And we now know for sure why he was in Berlin. Toys called me from the parking lot of some black site prison with an unpronounceable name."
Church stiffened.
"Das Verarbeitungszentrum?"
"Yeah, that one."
He explained that Toys, Violin, and Harry Bolt had tracked Ledger to the prison in hopes of making contact and either offering support or, ideally, bringing him in.
"The prison is gone, man," said Bug. "I hacked into the news and police feeds, and it's basically a burning crater. Total loss of life. All the guards and all the prisoners."
"And Colonel Ledger?"
"That's the thing," said Bug. "They saw him get out, him and Ghost, but they also saw a team of fixers there. And they were wearing that body armor."
"Which may explain the explosion," mused Church.
"Eve was with them," said Bug. "Violin thought she was running the crew."
"Now isn't that interesting?"
"Toys said that Joe mentioned a place in Germany he couldn't get into and a prisoner named Casanova. I did the background, and he was on Kuga's team."
"Yes," said Church. "Intelligence from one of our agents, Mia Cleave, callsign Magpie, helped put him there."
"Okay, well, Eve and her fixers brought someone out, but Violin says it wasn't Casanova."
"How sure is she?"
"You know Violin," said Bug. "She's sure. She gave me a good description, though, and I ran it through Q1. Looks like the guy they liberated was a lot more dangerous than Casanova."
Church leaned back and exhaled slowly through his nostrils. "And you're going to tell me it was Dr. Dejan Brozovic?"
Yeah.
Church picked up a cookie, looked at it, set it down, and pushed the plate away.
"Molecular biologist and organic chemist."
"They broke him out to work on R-33, didn't they?"
"Yes," said Church. "I'm afraid that's exactly what they did."
Chapter 113 Scandic, Berlin, Potsdamer Platz, Berlin, Germany. Peggy Ann Gondek sat in the cushioned armchair beside her hotel bed and punched in a series of coded numbers on a satellite phone. She nibbled a carrot stick as she waited for the call to go through. There was a towel spread on the duvet. She unzipped a small clamshell case and began lining up the items she needed. Milcom TW25B lubricant, a thin aluminum rod, a bottle of cleaning solvent, and a brush for a .22 barrel. The call had to be routed through several security steps, so she began disassembling the Ruger SR-22 that was her personal favorite. The model, not the specific weapon. She always disposed of her guns and knives before crossing borders and then picked up new equipment. She dropped the magazine, checked the breech, and made sure there was no round in the chamber. Then she rotated the slide lock lever to the vertical to unlock the slide from the frame. There was a click on the line.
"Hello, Mrs. Gondek," said a cultured voice. "Have you found our friend?"
"I have,"
she said. "Good," said Church. "We're going to need to make contact with him. Where is he now?"
"He just got back to the hotel,"
She gave the name of the hotel but did not know the room.
Don't suppose you heard anything about an attack on a processing plant in Vance?
That was our friend.
It was.
Peggy Ann pushed the spring forward toward the barrel very carefully and pulled it outward to remove the spring.
He got to the hotel less than an hour after things went boom, and he looked quite frazzled. So did the poor pooch.
There was the slightest pause on the other end of the call. Is he safe?
At the moment, sure. Overall? No, I wouldn't say so.
Another pause. Is he in control? Peggy Ann picked up the brush rod and sat tapping it thoughtfully against the gun barrel.
Define control, she said.
Chapter 114. Hotel Neue Fritz, Friedrichstrasse 10, Berlin, Germany. Eve sat against the headboard of the big king bed, trying to muster the courage to make a call. Daddy had given her two assignments, eliminate Casanova and exfiltrate Dr. Dejan Brozovic. One task had been satisfactorily accomplished, and the other almost certainly so. The whole building was a burning tomb, but almost certain was not the same as absolutely certain. Would it be enough for Santoro? She hoped so. Daddy giving her this mission was a big thing, the final test before he could tell Kuga that she was a completely reliable field operative. Kane and Abel were outside, watching the elevator and the door. She didn't want them around when she told Daddy about what happened at the processing plant. She didn't want them to see her cry. Her cell phone lay on the pillow next to her, where Adam's head should be. Every time she looked at it, she saw his face overlaid, as if he were there but made of hollow glass. Twice she'd tried to touch him, and both times she'd jerked her hand back from the nothingness.
I love you,
she murmured. The ghost of Adam smiled at her.
Love you too, babe, he said.
Tears rolled down her cheeks, mingled with snot from her leaking nose, hanging from her cheeks, and fell onto her chest.
I hate you for leaving me, you selfish prick,
she snarled and pounded her fist down on the mattress. It passed through him, and he dissipated like smoke. The jolt made the cell phone slide off the pillow. Eve took a steadying breath, pawed the tears from nose and mouth and cheeks, and returned the phone to the pillow.
I'll always love you, Eve,
Adam said softly. He touched her face, and Eve shivered. Goosebumps rippled along her thighs and up the outsides of her arms.
Big dummy,
she told Adam.
Going off and leaving me.
When she spoke to him like this, her voice was 10 years younger, the voice of the girl Adam rescued from the home where they'd both been incarcerated. That bothered her. Eve had swallowed a Xanax, but it hadn't hit her bloodstream yet. The lag time tempted her to take another, but she didn't, not yet. Last thing she needed was slurred speech, or worse, to puke her guts up while giving her report. Eve closed her eyes for a moment and looked inward and downward. In her mind, there was a big movie screen playing, and she was seated in the middle of the front row. As she watched, Joe Ledger drew his pistol, aimed it with great care at Adam, who stood with his hands raised in surrender. A cruel smile of sexual delight wormed its way onto Ledger's mouth as he slipped his finger into the trigger guard. Adam's mouth was open, his lips forming words, please, begging Ledger for mercy, but the big killer's smile became an orgasmic cry of wet delight as he pulled the trigger and shot Adam in the mouth, blowing the top row of teeth in, ripping through tissue and bone and nerve, and exiting in an explosion of blood and brains. Adam stared for a moment in disbelief, and then the light, that beautiful, pure, and perfect light went out of his eyes, and he collapsed back and down. Eve closed her eyes, squeezing them shut with such intensity that it forced tears out, shredding them between her lashes.
You got some wires connected wrong, sweetie, murmured Adam. I mean, you know that's not how it happened, right?
Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, she said helplessly. It is how it happened.
Okay, babe, said Adam. Whatever you say, whatever you want it to be, it's all okay.
She felt his hand touch her leg, tracing the outline of the brace she wore over the knee Ledger had destroyed with another bullet.
You know I'll always be right here, said Adam, right by your side.
It took her a long time to open her eyes. The cell phone was still on the pillow. Adam was barely an outline, but he was, as he said, still there, by her side.
You'd better make that call, suggested Adam. Don't want to keep Daddy waiting.
He'll be mad, she said in a tiny voice.
So let him be mad. You got the right guy out of there, didn't you?
I suppose.
Then you accomplished your mission.
We lost most of the team. Almost all of the righteous are gone.
Adam laughed.
You think Daddy cares about that stuff?
Eve sniffed, shrugged.
You still came out with the right prisoner, and that other guy, Casanova, he's dead for sure. No way he walked out of that place. Daddy's going to be really happy with you, babe.
But Ledger was there,
Eve protested.
I saw him on the body cams. He got away.
That wasn't your mission, Evie, sweetheart,
insisted Adam. She nodded, but didn't feel entirely convinced.
Look, babe,
said Adam, shifting a little on the bed, enough that the phone slipped off the pillow.
Just call him. Pull the bandage off. Let him yell if he wants to, but just know you did what he sent you there to do. You're his daughter. He loves you.
After a long string of moments, Eve reached through Adam's chest and picked up the phone. She did not see his eyes change from their perfect, deep, summer sky blue to a swirl of ugly green and brown. She punched in the number and held her breath until the call was answered.
Hello?
Said Rafael Santoro. Chapter 115 The Playroom. Undisclosed location near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Rafael Santoro closed the lid of the flip phone very slowly, quietly, and placed the instrument neatly on his desk blotter just to the left and below center. He considered it, then adjusted the angle so that it perfectly aligned with the other items on his desk. He was a small man, middle-aged, thin, wiry, and fit. There were scars on his swarthy skin, old, faded ones that were hidden by his tan, and newer ones that looked like flattened pink worms. His hair was intensely black but swirling with silver lines, his lips full and sensual. People who didn't know him well told him he had a gentle smile. He looked at the phone as if he could see Eve, his fractured little adopted daughter, a prodigy whose abilities outweighed her eccentricities, at least for now. Then he swiveled his leather chair around to face the tall man who stood by the wet bar, a tall glass of superb Japanese single malt in his hand. And? Asked the other man. Kuga looked like a younger Kevin Costner, broad-shouldered, all-American good looks, piercing blue eyes, and a very expressive smile.
Dr. Brozovich is on his way to the safe house, said Santoro. He will be on a plane first thing in the morning.
He okay? Last thing we need is him with his brains scrambled.
Eve says that he was rescued without injury. He is confused, but is cooperating with her.
Kuga sipped his whiskey.
Good. What about the team?
Santoro hesitated, searching for the right words to frame his response.
There were casualties.
How many?
4 fixers exfilled with Eve.
Only 4? Ouch! You can't tell me that a bunch of prison guards took down most of a top-tier strike team. Every goddamned one of them was juiced and jacked. They should have been able to walk into a military base and kick ass. Shit, we're counting on higher levels of opposition for G-55. How in the hell can...
He was there,
interrupted Santoro. Kuga froze. Who? Who was there? Santoro fought to keep his voice calm as he spoke the hated name.
Joe Ledger.
The room went dead still. Kuga gaped at him. And then he whirled and hurled the whiskey glass at the big mirror over the couch, which exploded in a shower of jagged splinters that slashed the leather. He swept his arm along the top of the wet bar and sent $5,000 worth of quality whiskey and brandy crashing to the floor. The bottles smashed apart and filled the air with the abusive stink of a distillery factory floor. The door banged open and two fixers entered, their sidearms drawn.
Get the hell out!
Roared Kuga, and they fled. He stormed through the room, kicking over the coffee table and knocking everything onto the floor.
How the fucking hell is Joe fucking Ledger at that fucking prison? How, Raphael? How? Does that mean he knows? Christ on a stick! Does Ledger know?
Santoro walked into the middle of the storm and stood right in front of Kuga. For a fragile moment, the taller man loomed over him, fist bunched, arm cocked, ready to strike. Santoro's arms were at his side, and fast as he was, there was no way he could have blocked or evaded that blow, and it stopped Kuga cold. The tall American stood panting, face flushed to a hypertensive scarlet.
Does he know, Raphael?
Asked Kuga again, and this time his voice was soft, desperate, even afraid.
Does Ledger know? Why else would he be there? Does Church know?
I don't know, my friend,
said Santoro, placing his hands on Kuga's broad shoulders. And it was a mark of how important this moment was that he meant that word, friend. He meant it. And Kuga felt it.
Do we need to stop the plan?
Santoro gave Kuga's shoulders a squeeze, then dropped his hands.
Eve said that Dr. Brozovic was liberated from his cell without incident. The violence at the processing plant was centralized in two places, the bunkhouse where the staff was sleeping, and the corridor outside Casanova's cell.
Kuga turned and walked over to the window, his lips pursed, eyes narrowed and calmer.
Casanova doesn't know about the American operation. As far as I know, all he was ever told was that there was one planned.
Yes, said Santoro. He knows that. And he knows about R-33. It was Brozovic who possessed the knowledge that could damage us. Eve insists that Ledger got nowhere near the wing where he was kept.
Kuga nodded, but said nothing.
As for Mr. Church,
said Santoro, wincing a little at the name,
I believe Ledger is still acting alone. There's been no team action, even when such a choice would have been tactically necessary to prevent Ledger from taking undue risks. No. He's out there on his own.
He's doing a hell of a lot of damage alone, said Kuga caustically.
He is. And sometimes a single man may accomplish what a full team cannot.
Santoro paused and then came at it from a different angle.
My surmise is that there are other hits we don't know about, maybe several. I think our Colonel Ledger is not merely slamming around collecting scalps. I think he is more in control than we give him credit for. Bear in mind, he was a police detective before he worked for the Demon Church, and he's learned a lot about international politics and espionage tradecraft, including interrogation strategies.
Kuka grunted and sat forward.
Well, that's an ugly damned can of worms. You think he's been getting names from his showier hits, killing some and using coercion on others?
It's possible. Even likely.
And those blabbermouths wouldn't fess up because they know how we'd react.
Anyone who talked to him would take that information to their graves rather than risk a visit from a fixer. Or from you.
Sadly, yes.
Kuga suddenly laughed. It was short and bitter, but genuine. God damn! Ledger is pulling a Rafael Santoro on us! The little Spaniard's face showed no amusement.
We need to review what each of the people at those locations knew. Most are like Casanova. They know there is an American operation and that it is tied to materials coded as G-55, but our circle of factual knowledge about the actual operation, the dates, location, intent, and timing is very tight. I cannot offhand think of a single person, not even Alexander Fong, Gerald Engelbrecht, or Mislav Mitrovich, who knows enough to matter.
Kuga rubbed his eyes and blew out his cheeks. So, who does that leave?
The leaders of the four fixer teams, and HK, of course, but they've all been confined to the pavilion, said Santoro. Gerald Crombie in London, the cat in Romania, and maybe three others who are here in this house.
Kuga walked across the room and back, avoiding the debris and broken glass. He stopped and stared out the window, hands thrust deep into his pockets. Then we need to make sure each of those targets is covered.
Oh, yes, said Santoro. I will make those calls now.
Chapter 116. Skandik, Berlin, Potsdamer Platz, Berlin, Germany. Peggy Ann Gondek stood in the middle of the hotel room and looked around. She'd closed the door after bypassing the keycard lock and stood now with a Snellig dart gun in her right hand. The Ruger SR-22 was tucked into a discreet clip on her belt, hidden by a baggy cardigan. She also had a double-edged stiletto strapped to her left forearm under her sleeve. The closets and bureau drawers were empty, room curtains and blackout drapes drawn, bed messed. A small laptop lay on the desk. She walked into the bathroom and surveyed the damage. The shower curtain was torn from almost all the rings, the plastic slashed. What was left of the mirror lay in glittering pieces on the tiled floor, each piece smeared with red. There were two words written in what she was absolutely certain was blood, scrawled on the wall. Umbra. Tenebris.
Darkness,
she murmured. Mrs. Gondek set her dart gun on the closed toilet seat lid and knelt. Something about the broken, red-smeared mirror troubled her, so she squatted down and took the pieces and began reassembling them. As she did so, what had originally appeared to be just smears formed two more words. They were written in a similar, but slightly different, hand. The words broke her heart. The words terrified her. Save me. A Shadow in the East. Part 6. The ignorant mind, with its infinite afflictions, passions, and evils, is rooted in the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. Bodhidharma. Instead of a man of peace and love, I have become a man of violence and revenge. Hiawatha. Chapter 117. Berlin Airport Club Lounge, Berlin Brandenburg Airport. Peggy Ann Gondek sat primly in a padded chair in a corner of the lounge where she could easily see the other customers coming and going. She had a tall glass of iced coffee on the table beside her and the colorful coils of a scarf trailing from her busy knitting needles. Like many travelers, she wore a Bluetooth headset. People smiled at her, and she beamed back at them. Not a smile of invitation, merely pleasant. Whenever someone came close enough to hear her quiet voice, she changed the subject to talk about stitches. Garter, pearl, stockinette stitches, as well as moss stitches, ribbing, and the basket weave stitches. She knew how to pitch her voice so that any subject could sound dreadfully dull, even knitting, which was her passion.
People generally did not want to sit within earshot and listen to her drone on and on about it.
"Alone again,"
she said as another person decided somewhere else was tranquiller and less lethally dull.
"Is he available yet?"
"Hold on," said a woman with a distinctly Brooklyn accent, and a moment later a man's voice spoke on the line. "Were you able to determine where our friend is heading?" asked Mr. Church.
"Oh, yes," said Peggy Ann. "Timișoara, in Romania. His flight leaves in a little over an hour."
"Can you be on the same flight?"
"Not a chance, dear heart," she said. "He got the last seat. Who would have thought so many people wanted to go to Timișoara?"
"That's unfortunate."
"I'm on standby for another flight," said Peggy Ann.
Mr. Church paused for a moment, then said, "Will you be able to locate him in Timișoara?"
"Oh, honey, of course."
"Let Bug know if you need any additional resources," and the call ended.
"Well,"
said Peggy Ann to herself as she continued working on the scarf,
"and a pleasant good afternoon to you, too."
She shook her head.
"Not even a proper goodbye. Humph."
She worked for another 10 minutes, finishing the row, and then packed up her things and headed down to find her gate. Chapter 118. Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. I had another blackout. Another day lost to the darkness. I have dim memories only of going to the airport and to search my pockets for the boarding pass I used. It told me I was in Romania. Why Romania? My hand hurt, and I realized it was bandaged. Somehow I'd cut the side of my fist. Had that happened at the processing plant? No, I didn't think so. I looked around. This was a nice hotel room, but which hotel? There was a directory of numbers attached to the phone, and it gave the name of the hotel and my own room number. Seeing that information began a process that had now become familiar. Details floated back, often without context, and I struggled to make sense of them. I had 4 different room key cards. They were laid out on the desk, and it took some effort to fish inside my broken head for what they represented. Not sure if that process took 5 minutes or an hour. All I know is that understanding came, slowly and reluctantly. These were keys for other rooms I'd booked. Then I jolted. "Ghost?" I called. But there was nothing. No sound. I ran into the bathroom, looking in the closets under the bed, but Ghost was not in that room. Panic tried to punch its way out of my chest. I found my shoes and put them on, found a gun, a Snellig. How in the fuck did I get that through customs? Nothing made sense, and the thought that I, in my fugue state, had either abandoned Ghost or I couldn't go there. I grabbed the room keys, tucked the gun into my waistband, and ran into the hall. "Ghost," I sobbed. "No." Chapter 119. The Pavilion, Blue Diamond Elite Training Center, Stevens County, Washington. Mia Cleave huddled in a treetop with Belle. It was midday and the fixers were creating thunder with live fire drills. A third of them were in body armor and a dozen in the K-110 fighting machines. During the night, they'd received intel from Scott Wilson about what the science team had been able to piece together. It was truly terrifying. The two women, though hidden and unsuspected by the enemy, were shaken to their cores, as was Andrea, who was at his post on the far side of the camp. His bird drones sent images to them and to the talk.
"God, I wish we could just call in a strike," muttered Mia. "Drop a fuel-air bomb and just erase this whole place." "I'm in harmony with that, Magpie," said Belle. "Plan B would be to just go in and cut some throats. Again, this is a good plan."
They smiled at each other, though both of them knew neither plan was ever going to be approved. Knowing part of what the enemy was doing was not enough. Sure, a powerful and direct military action could take out this camp, even with the fixers and their fighting suits and body armor, but what if this wasn't the only camp? What if this was only one of many such camps? What if taking this place out would cause the other camps to go into hiding? What then? The answer to each question was the same, and it was a terrifying answer. Chapter 120. Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. I found him in the last hotel room. Of course not the second or third, the fourth. I opened the door, and there he was on the bed, unmoving. My heart sank. No! I cried and ran to him, flung myself onto the mattress, and pulled him to me. He came, limp, boneless, eyes half open, tongue lolling. I pressed my head to his chest, praying that for once the universe wasn't that completely cruel. Kill me. Don't hurt Ghost. He's a dog. Dogs are pure love. They are mean if we make them mean, and they're not if we love and care for them. I listened to the vast nothing inside his chest, and then the slow, steady thump, thump, thump. It was only later, much later, after holding him for a long time, that I found the fragments of the Sandman dart pasted to the fur on his shoulder, where I, in my deepest darkness, had shot him. Chapter 121. Arclight Safehouse, Berlin, Germany. Toys stood looking out the window, hands in his pockets, shoulders slumped, head bowed.
You've been there for hours,
said Violin.
Come and sit, have some breakfast.
He shook his head. Harry, who was at the stove, pushing globs of eggs, onions, and diced potato around a pan, leaned close to her and in a confidential tone said,
What's this beef? He doesn't even like Joe.
Hush, Harry,
she said, and walked out of the kitchen and went to stand by Toys. After a few minutes, he said,
If you're going to give me a lecture, don't. Why would I lecture you?
He turned his head and looked at her. Violin had her long dark hair up in a loose bun and wore a baggy sweatshirt that made her slim body look thinner than it was. She wore no makeup, and that aged her, revealing tiny lines at the corners of her eyes and mouth. Toys had no idea how old she actually was. There were rumors that she was well into her 50s, though she looked, at most, even in the unforgiving sunlight pouring in through the window, about 30. Her mother, Lilith, had the same timeless quality and could reasonably be guessed at 40, 50, or 60, though Junie said she'd heard that Lilith was quite a bit older. Good genes? Or something else? He wasn't sure. For his part, he felt his years. He was not yet 35 and felt 90. His 20s had been spent doing harm to the world, and his 30s were, so far, some kind of holding action. Free Tech had given him purpose, but it also bored him to tears. He said,
You would have laughed if you'd been there when I appealed to church about getting back into the field. God, I was so righteous about it.
You must have been convincing.
Oh, sure, he said bitterly. I convinced him that somehow I, of all people, would be able to find Ledger and bring him back safe and sound.
Well,
she said with a wry smile,
you did find him.
And he bloody well shot me.
Be happy he used a dart gun.
Tell me, have you ever been shot with Sandman?
No.
It's not exactly fun.
Joy's capable of doing much worse.
Toys snorted.
Frankly, darling, I think I'd have preferred a beating.
Cars passed as people left their homes to go to work. The sight of that normalcy, that ordinary life, made him sad.
Look at them, he said. Everyone hurrying to get to their cubicles or their shops. Getting the kiddies off to school, thinking about picking up dry cleaning at lunch and going to the pub for a cold one after work with their mates. Maybe a PTA meeting or helping the kids with homework.
They,
said Violin,
are who we fight to protect.
He leaned his forehead against the glass, which was cool despite the sunlight.
I never had that, not even as a kid. I always got knocked around at home. Started getting into trouble when I was 11, and it only ever got worse. Then I fell in with Sebastian Galt, and that turned out to be a right shit show.
He sighed and straightened.
When I was in that life, I loved those people, truly hated them, held them in the highest contempt for being what they were. Ordinary. Nothing more unappealing to me. Then Ledger blundered into my life. And Church. That unnerving bastard Church. And Junie.
She thinks the world of you.
She shouldn't.
Why would you say that?
He avoided her eyes.
Because I'm not worthy of anyone's admiration, of fondness, or kindness. There's people out there. Even the most boring, mundane, mindless worker bee is worth 50 of me. 100.
You are valuable to the war.
The war is the war, he said, echoing one of Church's favorite sayings. Yes, I'm a good killer, so that makes me valuable as a person.
We are both killers, Toys,
said Violin,
and I have considerably more blood on my hands than you do.
Are you so sure about that?
Yes,
she said.
I am.
He turned to study her.
That sounds like a longer conversation than we have time for now.
Yes, and perhaps it's one we'll never have. Time will tell.
She paused.
So where are you going with your self-loathing? I mean, I don't want to sound callous, but are you going anywhere with this?
He laughed.
Nowhere of use, that's for sure.
Violin folded her arms and leaned against the wall beside the mirror.
Tell me something.
Sure. Would it help if I were to slap the self-pity off you?
Or would you prefer to go upstairs and flagellate yourself for a while? I can braid a rope and cake it in rock salt.
He stared at her for several long seconds.
Dear God, he said. I'm actually whining, aren't I?
Violin held her fingers up half an inch apart.
Just a little.
Toys looked up at the ceiling, and then he burst out laughing. After a moment, Violin joined him. In the kitchen, Harry, who was a good way into burning the eggs, glanced over his shoulder and wondered what the heck was so funny. They were still laughing when the smoke alarm went off, which made them laugh even harder.
Chapter 122 Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. I sat with Ghost all through the day and into the night. Even when, deep inside his drugged sleep, he peed the bed, it got all over me, but I didn't care. He could bite my face off, and it would be less than I deserved. And yet, when he finally woke up, he looked up at me with those big, liquid brown eyes and gave a sad, apologetic wag of his tail. He whimpered and pressed his muzzle against me, asking for my forgiveness for whatever wrong he'd done to deserve what I'd done to him. I don't know that I have ever felt more ashamed of anything in my entire life. I held him and rocked him, and then I carried him into the shower. Sat down fully dressed in the stall with him and let the water rain down. He licked water and tears from my face. I'm sorry, I told him. And I said it 1,000 times.
Chapter 123 Arclight Safe House, Berlin, Germany. Toys was shaving in the upstairs bathroom when his cell phone rang. It was Church. He took a steadying breath before answering.
Look, Toys said instead of hello, before you tell me what a failure I am, let me...
Save it, said Church. Tell Violin her jet is fueled and waiting for the three of you.
What? Why? To go where? Romania, said Church. Mrs. Gondek thinks she's found Ledger. No time, said Church. Go.
Chapter 124. RTI Safe House, Krampenberger Straße, Berlin, Germany. Otto Jaeger was not a happy man. Partly because he was deeply embarrassed. He had been in various covert ops groups for 13 years and had worked with Aunt Sally and Mr. Church for much of that time, following 7 years in the Deutsches Heer, where he'd been a Stabsfeldwebel and one of distinction. Being appointed the in-country liaison to Rogue Team International had been a big thing, a sign of trust, and a position of which he was rightly proud. And then Joe Ledger had knocked on the door and shot him with a Sandman dart. Just like that. There wasn't even a good brawl to look back on. No one would have expected him to win such a fight, but at least the anecdote would be better. In the right circles, he could dine out on the tales of a knockdown bout of fisticuffs with the legendary Colonel Joe Ledger. But no. Just a dart. Not even a conversation. Ledger had not gone so far as to show him the courtesy of a cover story or even a simple greeting. The door opened, and the lights went out. Jaeger woke on the couch with a blanket over him and a nice pillow under his head. So Otto Jaeger was not particularly cheerful. What made things worse was now Mr. Church, Scott Wilson, and the others at Phoenix House were being nice to him. Nice. He was getting emails from staff members asking if he was okay. He spent most of the day wandering around the safe house cursing Joe Ledger and everyone in his family going back 7 generations. Inventorying what Ledger stole was his ostensible job, but that only took 10 minutes. Now he had to rest and feel better, old chap, as Wilson had said 3 times.
Leck mich am Arsch, he snarled, and wished he had a picture of Ledger, and maybe one of Scott Wilson that he could piss on, or wipe his ass with.
When he heard a knock on the door while making coffee, he froze. Was it him again? There were no other RTI agents in Germany that he knew of, and no one else knew this place was anything more than a house where a bachelor lived a quiet life.
Fool me once, he thought, and tapped a concealed button to release a section of the wall behind which were a half dozen handguns.
One of them was a Snellig, loaded with Sandman. Jaeger pulled it free, checked the magazine, and crept to the door, smiling and thinking the blackest thoughts he owned.
"Wer ist es?"
he asked, leaning close to the door. He peered through the peephole, and there he was, tall, broad-shouldered, blonde, wearing a thick leather jacket, Ledger.
"Du Hurensohn,"
he thought, raising the pistol as he unlocked the door. He whipped it open just as Ledger turned around, except it was not Joe Ledger. This man could have been his brother, but it wasn't Joe. It was a stranger, and the stranger held a gun, a pistol with a long black sound suppressor. Jaeger brought his own gun up, and both weapons fired at exactly the same time. The glass dart struck the sleeve of the leather jacket and exploded harmlessly. The man's bullet took Jaeger in the hip, tearing through meat and exploding the bone, spinning him, detonating incredible agony all through his body. The man shoved Jaeger inside even before the agent could fall, then he kicked the door shut. The stranger slapped the Snellig from his hand and buried the hot barrel of the suppressor under Jaeger's chin. In very good, very clear German with a definite American accent, the blonde man said,
"Wo ist Joe Ledger?"
Where is Joe Ledger? Chapter 125. Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. I washed Ghost and myself. I brushed him and pampered him. I ordered his favorite stuff from room service. I took him for walks and played with him and spooned him when we needed to sleep. I'm pretty sure he knew I was feeling guilty and was milking the hell out of it. That's fine. He deserved it. We went and visited the other rooms I'd booked during my fugue, and in the second one I found the notes I'd written after my abortive conversation with Casanova. So much of that had been shoved back into the recesses of my brain because of the fight with the fixers, it took a while for me to remember that I'd written it down already and emailed it to Bug, which meant Church and everyone who mattered knew about what happened at the processing plant. That was good. It was important, and I had a feeling it was even more critical than it seemed. Those fixers had cutting-edge gear and were wearing suicide vests, ones that went boom in a way that was out of all proportion to what I knew of explosives. The possibilities were staggering. However, I trusted Church, Wilson, Bug, and Doc to grasp that potential and put the right wheels in motion. For now, though, I had to concentrate on this part of my mission, my self-imposed mission. Was this getting me anywhere close to Santoro? In a very weird way, I found that I almost didn't care. I was becoming weary of hate. That was something I didn't think was possible. My family was 7 months in the ground. Nothing I did would change that, not even their ghosts showing up. I was probably clinically insane, and this course of action sure as shit wasn't driving me in the direction of a cure. I wasn't sure if I could finish this mission. Now, let me correct that. I wasn't sure if I should. Not that mission. Not finding and killing Rafael Santoro. It took me a lot of hours pacing in my hotel rooms, walking ghost, lying in bed staring at the ceiling to work it through. If this were a movie, I'd have covered a wall with 3x5 cards, post-it notes, and colored pushpins, and tied everything neatly together with red string, but that was the movies, and this was my life. The darkness had receded further this time. I could barely feel it back there in some corner of my mind. Don't know why. Didn't care. What mattered was the picture coming together from what I'd learned in Italy, Poland, South Africa, the Netherlands, and Germany. On some level, I was pretty sure I had nearly all of it. The cybernetics, high-end body armor, fighting machines with human drivers. Some kind of mind-altering chemical compound that drove the fixers mad while giving them extra speed and strength. The suicide vests and whatever high explosive they were packed with. Something called the American Operation. Those pieces had all floated around loose because I'd collected them piecemeal here and there, and sometimes while in a fugue state. But now, a bit more clear-headed, I could see how there was a sense to it, a cohesion. Somewhere in America, fixers with chemical enhancement, cybernetics, bulletproof armor, and advanced weapons were going to stage a strike. Knowing Kuga and Santoro, it was going to be big, something that would draw a lot of attention, but at the end of the day, Kuga wanted to sell more weapons of conflict. Just as the rage attacks in the two Koreas and at the denuclearization summit in Oslo were never really about unifying North and South Korea or stopping the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Just the reverse. Kuga wanted to keep the world always on the brink of war because when things are peaceful, no one's buying as many guns. This, quite simply, made sense. I was here in Romania to see someone called Die Katze, the cat, a salesman high in the Kuga organization, someone who might actually know what this American operation was, or at least give me enough so I could keep going. Keep going, I said out loud. Did I want to? Need to? Have to? Or was it time to lay down my sword and shield and let Church take it from here? I smiled up at the ceiling. Yeah, sure. Let me go sit on the sidelines and have a footlong and a cold beer while the world blows up. Let me sit it out while other people, better people, put themselves in the line of fire in my place because I was too sad and weary
No fucking way, I said. Ghost looked at me and thumped the bed with his tail. When I looked at him, he bared his titanium teeth at me. Maybe it was a snarl. Maybe it was him laughing. He wasn't buying that bullshit either. I looked at my watch. Game time, furball, I said. Chapter 126. Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. They were being very careful. I stood with my face pressed against my door, peering through the peephole at the four men who stepped off the elevator. Three were big, with the kinds of faces that would pretty much guarantee they'd never work in customer service. Lumpy, craggy, with crooked noses and humorless, unimaginative eyes. They wore sport coats that they unbuttoned the moment they stepped out of the lift. Even from a third of the way down the hall, I could see the bulges beneath their jackets. Two right-handers and a lefty. All of them should have had "thug" tattooed on their foreheads. The fourth man was approximately the size and shape of a mailbox. No neck, but not because he was over-muscled, he was simply very short and very obese. His face was florid and beaded with sweat. He had a sparse beard and mustache and a sharp nose that he could have used to peck a hole in tree bark. He was the one I cared about. He had the briefcase filled with money to buy something I wanted very much. Something he was going to buy from Decazzi. The four of them walked past my room, the guards clicking their eyes left and right, looking for threats, but clearly not expecting any. It was a nice hotel, elegant and quiet. As I watched the men in the hall, I could feel Ghost watching me, patient and just as hungry as I was. He remembered what we'd had to do to get this far. Questions had to be asked. I always ask nicely the first time. Not so much if they stonewall me. The men stopped at a door only four down from mine. The upside was that I now knew the room number, but the downside was that it was at a bend in the hall, where someone inside that room doing exactly what I was doing might see me coming. That was a problem to be solved in motion. For now, I waited and watched. The small man with the woodpecker nose rapped four times on the door, two distinct sets of two beats. He paused and repeated it. Someone inside spoke, but I couldn't hear it. However, I did hear the small man reply,
"Dragoș mă trimis."
Dragoș sent me. I had no idea who that was and assumed it was just a code word, like the old speakeasies Lefty sent me. Then he repeated the double rap again. There was the three count, and then the door opened. The small man entered the room accompanied by one of his guards. The other two turned their backs to the door. Normally, you'd think that would skew the math, but it didn't. With two guys watching the door, no one was likely to be peering through the peephole. I could work with that. I checked my weapon and made sure the magazine was full. There was a 6 hour 9mm snugged into the waistband of my trousers, firm against my left kidney, and two extra mags for it in my right pants pocket. Nothing else in there to interfere with grabbing one, and the pocket opening was sewn with a strip of elastic so it would stretch for an easy pull. However, the pistol I held in my hand was my Snellig dart gun. Why the dart gun? Partly because it was whisper quiet, partly because I wasn't sure if some of the people in that room were non-combatants or non-hostiles. And partly because I wanted the option to exfil someone with a pulse so I could ask a bunch of questions they couldn't answer if they were dead. The SIG was there in case things went sideways, and I wanted to send some of these assholes to Jesus on a fast train. I paused to take a look at myself in the mirror. Nice, quiet business suit, hair combed, fake glasses and a fake mustache. I looked ready to sell used cars in Akron. I even tried on a smile. I wanted it to look convincing, affable, nondescript. But it fell wrong on my face, and I looked phony in the mirror. I haven't been smiling all that much lately. I heard a soft woof behind. "You can keep your opinions to yourself, Fleabag." He woofed again, eloquently. "You want to sit there being snotty, or do you want to go play?" His bushy tail thumped on the duvet. "Well, then stop lying around eating bonbons and get your furry ass in gear."
He immediately launched himself from the bed and went to stand, glaring at the door, giving me hurry-the-hell-up looks.
"Let's go be naughty," I said, and opened the door.
Chapter 127. The Playroom, undisclosed location near Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Kuga got through after 6 failed attempts.
"Hello, my friend," said Mr. Sunday.
"Fuck you with hello," growled Kuga.
"Well, you seem like you're in quite a state. Someone piss on your new shoes."
"Cut the shit, Sunday. I want to know what the hell you're playing at."
"At the moment, I'm playing with my dick."
Kuga closed his eyes and resisted the urge to hurl the phone across the room.
"You said that you were going to mess with Ledger."
"And I am."
"Oh, really? He's out of his mind, but he's also tearing my organization apart."
Sunday gave a long, exaggerated, and comical sigh.
"Haven't we had this conversation before? Is it 9 times now or 10?
"He is out there killing people."
"And you are there, safe and sound, planning to kill a lot more people than he is," said Sunday. "I've been having some lovely chats with our friends and all those well-regulated militias. We're going to have such fun."
"Yeah? And what if Ledger gets to them and makes them talk?"
"He won't."
"How would you know? You haven't stopped him from killing my guys in South Africa and Italy and all those other places."
"I haven't, because I did not try."
"What?"
"Let me rephrase that," said Sunday.
"Yeah, I think you'd fucking well better."
"I haven't stopped him from killing those people because I don't care about them. I really don't. They are nothing to me because they have already done what I, and of course I mean we, have required of them. Ledger is cleaning things up for us while thinking he is doing you harm."
"You're insane," Sunday laughed.
"If that is the worst thing that you think I am, my friend, then I am very disappointed," and he hung up.
Kuga stared at the phone, but he did not throw it. Chapter 128. Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. We stepped into the hall. Ghost can look like a middle-aged house pet when he wants to, and I can look shorter and slower than I am. It's a posture thing, and the way you set your shoulders and how you walk. And I composed my facial features to sell it. My lips were loose, rubbery, as if I were lost in thought, and my line of sight was vague, as if I were in my own head and not looking at anything or anyone. I stood in the hallway patting my pockets like an absent-minded guy making sure he had his car keys, billfold, and cell phone. There were security cameras in the hall, but I'd already hacked into the system using gear I'd lifted from the safe house in Germany. I'd recorded 6 minutes of empty hall and fed it back in on a loop. Then I clicked my tongue for Ghost, and we began walking along the hall, angled so there was no sense of obvious interception, just a man and his dog. Until we were 6 feet away. Then I brought the Snellig out very fast and smooth and shot them both in the face. They went down right away. No pause, no groans, no cries of alarm. Sandman does not ask, it tells. I rushed forward and caught them both, groaning under their combined weight, and dragged them back from the door before laying them on the dark red carpet. I needed to get in, but modern hotel doors are notoriously hard to kick open, especially in the better hotels. Last thing I needed was to raise a ruckus kicking the thing 4 times, or to lame my foot. So I removed a small device roughly the size of 3 stacked quarters, peeled off the film on the back to expose the adhesive, pressed it to the locking mechanism, pushed the little silver button, and backed up quickly, raising the gun. The device, known affectionately as a party popper, blew the lock apart. I kicked the door and rushed into the room, firing through the thin veil of smoke. "Ghost," I growled. "Hit, hit, hit." He hit. We both did. There were 7 people in the room, 6 men, 1 woman. Ghost hurled himself like a pale missile at the closest man, a big bruiser, who had to be 6'8".
Over the years, Ghost has lost 10 teeth in combat. Each one has been replaced with a titanium fang, and there's some additional reinforcement to allow the dog to use those chompers to maximum effect. Ghost bit into the muscular forearm of the big man as the guy was pulling his pistol. Even with all the noise, I could hear bones break. Man and dog went down hard. I fired at everything that moved. It was a hotel room, a suite, and one of good size, but everyone was clustered around a coffee table. My shots caught them rising in confusion, reaching for weapons, but not actually able to point them. Not in time. Sandman works at the speed of nerve conduction. Ghost left the big man screaming and went after the third of the guards who'd come with Woodpecker. That man went down with a savaged thigh, and he had a choice. Try to shoot or use both hands to clamp down on a torn femoral artery. The man chose wisely. A man swung a pistol toward me, but I blocked the wrist with a blow from my left hand and shot him in the cheek. Suddenly, six men were down, and the only person standing was the woman. She gave me a look of mingled terror and lethal hate and dove over the back of the couch, coming up with a neat little handgun I hadn't seen on her. She rose up firing, but I was moving, changing angle and distance, and the range was bad for her, but good for me. I chopped down on her wrist hard enough to break things, then kicked her in the stomach. She folded into a knot that was tight as a fist. Then I shot the two men Ghost had injured. One was going to bleed out and die. Fuck it. The other was going to need a lot of surgery. Too bad. The whole fight took about 4 seconds. I looked down at the woman, shrugged, and shot her with Sandman. Then I left them all there and found a housekeeping closet, tricked open the lock, and grabbed a big canvas laundry cart on wheels. I took it back to the room and loaded my three sleeping beauties into it and then hid them with towels and sheets I pulled from the bed. "In," I said, and Ghost jumped into the cart and I covered him with a duvet. The briefcase Woodpecker had been carrying was on the coffee table next to an identical one. Both were locked, both went in with the laundry, along with everyone's wallets and cell phones. Then I was out the door, wheeling the cart to the elevator. There was nothing in the room where Ghost and I had spent the night. My borrowed gear was downstairs in the first room where I'd awakened from my fugue. And besides, I didn't want to be anywhere near this room, so we took the service elevator. I got into that elevator just as the main elevator doors pinged open and two security guards and an assistant manager hurried out to investigate reports of a disturbance. I pushed up my sleeve to allow access to the thin, flexible tactical computer strapped to my forearm and disabled the video loop. They never saw me. I rode the car down to the fifth floor, fed the empty hall loop to those cameras, exited, and after making sure the hall was clear, wheeled the cart to the other room I'd booked, got inside, reactivated the security cameras, and sent a signal for Mind Reader to erase all traces of my hack. Closed and locked the door, leaned against it, and exhaled, blowing out my cheeks. Ghost raised his head and peered at me, grinning to show his bloody metal teeth. Chapter 129 Hotel Timișoara, Timișoara, Romania. Ghost hopped out of the cart, taking a particularly stinky and stained bedsheet with him, and I had to bribe him with doggy treats to relinquish it. Last thing I needed was my dog rolling around in someone's love puddle. Silly damned mutt. I overbribed him and he went off happy, wearing the kind of look successful con men use when their scam has worked exactly as planned. He settled down in the entrance to the bathroom, belly on the cool tiles, head and front paws in the bedroom, nibbling the treats. I removed my stolen jacket and hauled the dozing bad guys out of the cart, used flex cuffs on their ankles and wrists, and sat them in a neat row against the wall. This room was a corner suite, and I booked the only adjoining room, which was empty, under another fake name. I turned on the radio, found an opera channel, and dialed the volume high. There was a small medical kit on the bedside table, and I removed three small sirettes and placed them on the edge of the bed. The woman looked like Cruella de Vil, but without the obvious warmth or humanity. She sat on one side of Woodpecker with Slender Man on her other side. I sorted through the IDs, ran them through the mind reader unit, making a mental note to send poor Otto Jaeger something really nice for Christmas. and was in no way surprised when they all pinged as phony. So I used the touchpad on my tactical computer to take their fingerprints and also send clear photos, and I kicked all that stuff over via satellite to the mind reader mainframe in Greece. Bug would be going nuts. And once more, the RTI crew would know where I was and what I was doing. Somehow that mattered less to me than it had before. I felt, one way or another, my time of hiding and running was coming to an end, which, of course, made me think of Junie. I love you, babe, I thought, wondering if somehow, intuitive as she is, she could hear me. You deserve so much better than me, but I love you with my whole heart. Ghost gave a single short bark, and when I looked at him, I swear to God he nodded. Only once, but I damn well saw it. Jesus. While I waited for replies, I set about examining the two cases. They were both the same make, model, and color, with 9-digit keypad locks. Very expensive. And this kind of case had steel mesh beneath the leather exterior. Pick-proof and cut-proof. For just about everyone except cats like me. I attached tiny leads to the keypad of the first one, connected the other ends to my tactical computer, and let Mind Reader sort out the combination. Took longer to connect the wires than get the code. The lock obliged by clicking open. I repeated it with the other case and was amused to see that it was the same combination, suggesting that the bags were intended to be swapped. I was briefly unnerved to discover that each case contained a small explosive device wired to the locks. They were rigged to blow if those locks or the hinges were forced. The bombs weren't big, but they would have very effectively blown me in half had I been less careful. God damn, I said. In the woodpecker's bag, I found lots of money. $650,000 in bearer bonds. 2 bundles of cash in mixed Romanian lieu notes bound by rubber bands. I thumbed through the bills and estimated around 500 grand in lei, which shakes out to a bit over 100 G's in American dollars. There were also 10 bundles of euros in 2 and 500 denominations, about 22,000 euros, which made it just shy of 27,000 bucks. I figured the euros were a partial payment for Cruella's team, since they were black marketeers who worked this part of southeastern Europe, while the lei were for paying local help. At the bottom of the bag, I found a burner phone with a single number programmed in. I ran that through Mind Reader 2, and it accessed a system for wire transferring much larger amounts. Once a call was made and a certain code typed in, 10 million euros would be transferred to a numbered account in the Seychelles. I did not have that code, but I had a whole afternoon ahead of me, so anything at all could happen. I waved a stack of cash at Ghost. There's almost enough here to keep you in doggy treats for a week, he wagged at me. I pointed at the 3 prisoners. They're evil. Bet you want to chomp on them some, don't you, boy? More wags. My dog is as bug-fuck nuts as I am. This is not a news flash. I opened the other case and found a smaller container inside, white styrofoam sealed with red biohazard tape. No labels, though, and nothing inside the case or container to indicate what I'd just found. "Ruh-roh," I said in my best Scooby-Doo voice. I left the tape in place, closed the case, and picked up a Sirette. "Eeny, meeny, miny, moe," I said. "Catch a psychopath by the toe." Cruella DeVille lost, and I jabbed her in the arm. "Wakey, wakey." Normally, Sandman takes hours to flush out of the bloodstream, but Doc Holliday came up with something she calls jumpstart. It wakes a Sandman victim up pretty fast, but there are some unfortunate side effects. The woman's eyes popped open, she pissed herself, and then vomited onto her lap. Despite her feeling what was probably a level 10 pounding headache, and the obvious humiliation of having